Hi, everyone. Talk
Radio.
Welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network and our program on the third Sunday of each month. Wait a minute. This is the fifth Sunday, so it is a special edition of our show.
That's right.
of moving forward. I'm your host, KJ Jones, Kelly KJ Jones, brain injury survivor and now life coach. My co-host, Dr. Valentina, a clinical psychologist, is here to discuss the emotional aspects beyond our physical injuries. Moving forward, we'll host candid discussions with persons who have experienced a brain injury and certified clinicians who have assisted survivors. Their insight on discovery as well as the line between pain tolerance and pain threshold will provide more pathways to hope, success, and the momentum for sustainable recovery. Ooh, all in one breath. That's all right. Dr. Valentina, how are you today?
I am doing good, my girl. How are you?
You're doing good. Where are you?
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
That's right. You should hear my 4 and 3 year old. They say Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico. They have a little song that they kind of march around to.
Wow. So, what's it like there? What's the weather like and everything?
It is so beautiful. Of course, hot. Some level of humidity. But just so beautiful, like, you know, the people are great, the ambiance is great. Like, of course, this is where half of my family is on my dad's side. And so it's always nice to kind of visit a familiar place that I came to often, you know, during childhood.
Yeah. Puerto Rico is one of my favorite places in the world.
Mm-hmm. I always thought that
I have been a whole lot of places in the world, so... But I love Old San Juan. We stayed in Old San Juan, Isla Verde, and I stayed at the El Conquistador. And my mom had a student from Puente.
Oh, wow. Have you ever gone to El Yunque there, the rainforest?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Quick story. We went to the rainforest the last time we were there, and it was in the middle of Hurricane Andrew. And we drove past all these places that were boarded up, or, you know, places that were boarding up for the hurricane. Mm-hmm. Yes, most definitely. Wow. I remember.
Wow. It's amazing, like, what different events will kind of trigger. The memory will kind of trigger, like, the reminder of what was happening. You know, what's tripped out is, despite having been to Puerto Rico over 10 times, I have never been there. And so I vowed, me and my husband, to make this family trip, like, you know, where we just regularly visit family members, a time where we also have a little mini vacation and go to El Yunque. So for the first time, I'll actually be, you know, going there, which is tripped out because, you know, like I said, I've been there over 10 times and never have gone.
Wow. Well, I know it is beautiful. Speaking of family,
yes,
Speaking of family, tonight's guest has a phenomenal, phenomenal story of family support, family encouragement. The person that we're going to be interviewing tonight, his name is Todd Whiteside. Todd, I went to school with Todd. And Todd is actually, we went to UNC together. He's a Tar Heel. Todd has actually suffered a brain bleed, and subsequent, he had a surgery with an appendectomy. He's gone through a lot in life, and the story that he has to tell, the story that he has to share is amazing. Todd has actually gone through he is a survivor of a hemorrhagic stroke, which is a brain bleed, and the thing that is even more surprising about that is approximately 30% of individuals, only 30% of individuals who go through this type of stroke survive beyond 5 years. A stroke is something I had never really looked into before this interview tonight, but actually there is, please forgive me, every 40 seconds someone has a stroke. Every 40 seconds there is someone who has a stroke. And every, in the U.S., I'm sorry.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and so anyway, what I wanted to do was I wanted to bring on Todd. I think Todd has called in. As you know, I'm a big advocate of including sports in everything as much as possible, staying healthy and staying fit. One of the things that I found out about strokes also is that the average age for a person having a stroke is over age 60. But there was a story of a young man, Robbie Bryce, who is a baseball player that had a stroke at age 15. Age 15, he's a high school, not softball, baseball player. And within 1 year, he recovered. Teddy Bruschi, I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but he played in the NFL, and he also suffered a stroke. 8 months later, he was back playing in the NFL. And, Kenny Anderson, who played for the Nets, New Jersey Nets, also suffered a stroke. So strokes are more commonplace than we would think. And as I said, we have a true survivor, a true hero, hopefully on the line. Is that you, Todd?
Yeah, I'm here.
And greetings.
So, Todd is
Hello,
here to
hello,
tell
everybody.
Us about his story. How are you doing tonight, Todd?
I'm doing okay. Got a little cold, but I'm fighting through it.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Oh, so some folks would say, you got the cooties.
No. You got a little head cold.
You know what? My granddad, on my mom's side, he would always say a cold's trying to get me. He would never claim that he had it because he's like, I don't want it. You know, so he would always say a cold is trying to get me, even if it got him. Even if it got him now, he would never claim that he had it. So it's funny, as you're saying, it got the cooties, I'm thinking about what I also learned about colds, you know.
That's right. Look, what is the exchange policy? Just put it back on the shelf.
Right.
So, Todd, I was explaining to you, I think I told our audience that we went to Carolina together, and but of course, you know, I'm a lot younger. Just kidding.
No, you're not.
To Carolina together, and when I met Todd, oh God, maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, he was telling me that he had a stroke, but he was out and he was vibrant and he was the same old Todd. And each and every time I talk to Todd, I just, you know, I'm amazed at his love of life, his positivity, and the things that he you know, just the things that he does, the things that he's doing, and the thing, and his aspirations, and his kids, and his family, and stuff. So that was why I wanted to bring Todd on again tonight. So, Todd?
Yes.
Yeah. Good. So I was wondering, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about you and sports and growing up and et cetera. Who's Todd Whiteside?
Well, I'm just a good old country boy from North Carolina. I grew up in a small town, played sports all my life, went to Carolina, tried my hand at football, and that wasn't all that great. Came back home, got married, had a couple kids, ended up going back to Carolina because I didn't do it right the first time, and finished college, went to work, traveled around and did different jobs, and all the while, my wife stayed at home, and she was teaching and principal and getting her master's and doctorate degrees, and eventually, I came back home and went to work for a Freightliner Corporation, and from there, I went on to doing executive recruiting.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
Let me take you back for a second with the high school sports and college sports and et cetera. When you were in high school, what did you play? What sports did you play?
I played every sport. But I played football, basketball, and track. I was fourth guard on the basketball team. Played every position in football. And I ran the 400 meters in track and did the long jump.
Wow.
What do you think sports did for you?
Taught me discipline.
Discipline. Do you think it taught you, explain like discipline then?
To not give up on anything, to keep fighting, try to win at everything.
Yeah.
So that's just the attitude I have. You're never out of anything.
Well, were you on a winning team? Did your school win?
Oh, yeah. Basketball. Football, we weren't that good. Football was my best sport, but football, we weren't that good. Basketball, we were team in the state for years.
Wow. So do you have some of those, like, Al Bundy trophies and stuff and Al Bundy stories?
I've got a few. I was the most outstanding athlete my senior year, so I've got some Al Bundy stories.
Did you really?
My daughters could tell you more about that than me because they have to hear them. But my daughters were good athletes, so.
Wow.
Especially my oldest. She went to the state every year in track.
Wow.
So part of what...
I said, like it got passed down, you know, from daddy to daughter.
Yeah, well, my wife was a track star, too. She went to the state in track when she was in high school.
Oh, almost inevitable then, you know.
She had good genes.
Yeah. Wow. So when you say that you were in sports and it taught you self-discipline, do you see the difference in even preparedness in general? Like, do you see how that could have impacted you overall in life with regards to discipline?
Oh yeah, you get out of stuff what you put into it. If you don't put anything into something, you can't get anything out of it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh yes. I meant to tell you guys that my daughter is on the line too. I had did a call with her before I called you guys, so she could tell you a lot more about me than I could.
Hi,
Oh, hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are y'all?
Great.
Your dad says my daughter, but he has never told us your name.
I'm Sloan.
Sloan?
Yes, named for Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, no way! We were just talking about that movie earlier today. We were just talking about Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So,
compliments of my dad, of course.
Yeah. So we were talking generally, I mean, I guess you just heard us talking about sports and the determination that it provides, the tenacity that it provides. I was wondering, and you and your dad can talk about this, Do you think that in sometimes sports actually increases your pain tolerance level?
I for sure think it does. I actually work with I'm an entertainment attorney, and I work with some athletes, and we've been having discussions recently, particularly around the Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles situation. And being a former athlete, you know, I was always told, and I think my dad probably the same, you know, unless you're bleeding or you can't get up and walk, you need to get up and play.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just kind of our mentality. It wasn't, you know, it probably wasn't always healthy. And I think there's like a lot of movies, Varsity Blues is one of them. There's a lot of movies that kind of talk about how dangerous that can be to the athlete. But, you know, growing up, you learn discipline and you learn to fight through everything. And that's just something that we did. But I don't think there was a lot of discussion about, you know, mental health and the long-term effects of some of those injuries. So it definitely increased. I think I probably had a few concussions myself. My dad's concussions obviously rival mine, but I've had a few myself. And, you know, I didn't really, it's never deterred me from not wanting to play sports. It just was kind of like, okay, this is something that happened. I need to get up and do it again. But those can have long-term side effects and health issues. And that's not something I really thought about until I got older.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. How did you know there was a concussion?
I blacked out.
What?
A few times, yeah.
How did it start?
I think the first one I was actually, I wasn't playing a sport. I was like 4 and I was riding my bike and I fell and hit my head and had stitches. And then I had a few playing basketball. We didn't have padding in our school gym. And if you go head first into the wall, it's a brick wall. So I slid into that wall a few times. And I've always been kind of like, I was right modeled after my dad. Mama always played sports, so always kind of like out and about. So it didn't faze me. I broke a few fingers and it just kind of kept going. But now that I understand kind of the ramifications of my concussions, I probably would have thought a little bit differently about them, especially after reading a lot of the studies, particularly after my dad had his stroke. I would have thought differently about how hard I played and whether I should have, gotten more proper protocol afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Todd, did you have any concussions growing up? Todd.
You there, Dad?
Hello?
Oh, he's awesome.
We can hear you.
Okay. I had to step away for a second.
Your cough got you?
Yeah.
They had asked if you had concussions growing up.
Actually, I think I may have had one playing football. I didn't have any. I think I had one when I was in Chapel Hill, one in high school. And that's it. I mean, but you don't really pay much attention when you're playing sports. You just we call it getting a bell rung.
I heard that.
And, you know, you get a little hazy, you get a little dizzy, you get up, get your consciousness back, and then you go back at it. Back then, we didn't even, you were out of practice for a day or so. Now they keep you out for periods of time. But back then, it was totally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like they have to learn experience. I was saying it's kind of like they have to learn through experience that some of the cultural norms that they were setting was off, it had dire repercussions. And so it's almost like, the next generation, then it becomes a little better and a little better, but that's only, of course, with certain things. With other stuff, it seemed like the next generation is getting worse and worse,
Yeah, we did. Excuse me. My generation was the 80s, so it was pretty bad. So, you know, we had guys that were taking steroids, and it was sanctioned by the doctors back then. You
know? Wow.
They would make sure that you didn't do too much or hurt yourself or do, you know. But it was common knowledge that guys were taking steroids back then.
Wow. I'm just thinking of the repercussions of that, like on their own bodies, because we know that there's, like, terrible ones. Then I would think even on the people that they were hitting, because don't they feel like hitting a brick wall almost?
I don't know. I never took them, but I just knew that certain guys were, you know, 180 pounds one year and the next year they're 240, 230, 240. So they were doing something.
Well, you know, as soon as you said that, I started Googling to find out what it says, and it actually says that steroids increase the risk that blood clots will form in the blood vessels. So that could also impact So, Todd, one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, when you were doing all this in school, what was the regiment like? Hold on one second.
Yeah, we get feedback, and I didn't hear very clearly that last piece you said after blood clot.
Hello. Did somebody just join us?
No.
I think it's just us four. I hope it's just us four.
Wait, is your daughter's number 337?
No.
No.
Okay, someone area code 337. Okay. So anyway, what I was asking is, or one of the things I was thinking is that with the regiment of the schedule that you have in school and the regiment of the schedule, the sports and everything that's going on, that sometimes maybe like a concussion kind of gets pushed aside or an injury gets pushed aside because you have so much going on, not only in the sports, but you've got academics, you've got travel schedule, you've got all these different things, all these different demands, as well as, you know, a head injury.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fortunately for me, I only went through it for a couple of years. Because, like I said, I was doing a lot of things in school, and I really wasn't taking care of my schoolwork. So I had to concentrate on my school after those couple of years, and I only played football for a couple of years. But during that time, it was time-consuming. You have your day is basically made out for you before you get up. You got class, you got study hall, you have, you know, eat, you have meals, you have workouts, you know, it's a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Because they say one of the precursors for a stroke is high blood pressure. And, you know, we associate high blood pressure with stress.
And that was my situation. I had high blood pressure and had no idea that I had high blood pressure.
Wow.
Until it was too late. I was actually driving to a high school basketball game, and I didn't feel well, but I didn't feel like I was having a stroke. And then when I tried to get out of the car, I couldn't move my left leg. So I had to hop to the back seat of the car. My wife drove me to the hospital. By the time I got to the hospital, it was moving up my arm, and I couldn't move my arm. So they had to put me under. They basically saved my life. I was that close to leaving. So they had to put me under so that the blood flow was slow, because I was basically dying in front of them.
Oh, my God.
And they got me to another hospital and woke me up. I went under, and I didn't remember anything until I woke up in another hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And they were preparing to do surgery on the bleed, but it dried up on its own.
Well, what happened before the ride? What happened when you were in the car?
I was driving, and then when it came on, I couldn't get out of the car. And then once I got in the back seat, it felt like I was just tumbling, like I was being tossed around, and I wasn't. She was driving normal, but it felt like my whole body was just being thrown from side to side in the car.
You know what he said, the piece about sort of waking up and not knowing what like, you know, basically all this time having passed, that's actually a common symptom that we're hearing, or reaction response that we're hearing across interviewees, you know, who start to experience these injuries in a sense. You know, so that's pretty, seems pretty common. I'm just curious, how old was your baby girl when this happened?
Two daughters at the time, and my baby was 13, and the one that we're talking to, she was a freshman at Carolina.
Oh, wow. Wow, so it's got to be some scary news for everybody, right, all the way around.
Oh, yeah.
So what did you hear? I mean, what was the story that you heard when everything was going on?
They called me. I think I was in my dorm February, and, you know, I can tell my mom, she's usually pretty calm, but she wasn't. She was like, you need to speak to your dad, and I was like, what's going on? What's wrong? And she was like, you know, just speak to him and tell him everything you want to tell him. And so, of course, that kind of, like, freaks me out because I don't really know what's happening. And she's trying to explain to me, but she's like, I think she's out of it a bit, and she's trying to go and get my grandmother, and she has my baby sister with her, and so... You know, they were like, she was just like, talk to your dad, tell him that you love him, you know, say what you need to say. They're going to, you know, he's having the stroke, they're having to put him under, and she's like, I'm not going to lie to you, you know, they don't know if he's going to come out. And,
oh, my
gosh. She was, I mean, I appreciate, we've always, I think with me as the oldest, they've always been very honest with me, which I appreciate because I don't really like sugarcoating anything. They're a little bit more tactful with my baby sister because she's the baby, but you know, she just kind of told me what it was, and I was appreciative because I did need to say things, and you know, had I not gotten to say all those things, I think I would have been upset. Had she kind of downplayed the situation for me, so you know, I don't think he remembers, but I was telling him I love him and that I was doing well at school and I was going to make Dean's list and just kind of going through the things that I could think of at the time that he might want to hear. And then I didn't have a car that year, and so I think my luckily we have a very big family and everyone's super well connected, and my cousin came, my mom called my cousin, and my aunt, my mom's sisters, kind of like got into action, so they were trying to figure out how to get me home. And so they called my sister. They called my cousin who was in Raleigh. She came and picked me up, and I stayed with her for a little bit. She drove me halfway, I think, to my aunt who was in Charlotte or Greensboro. Or I think they met in Winston. And then my aunt drove and picked up my sister and my brother, and we all kind of went up to the hospital, which by the time that I was able to get up there, I think he had woken up. And it was the news, he was more stable, and the news was more positive. This was, I want to say, it was probably like 20 hours later, though, because I found out kind of that evening, the evening before, and I didn't really get up there, I think, until like noon the next day. But by the time I got up there, you know, he was awake, and, you know, we were about to watch Carolina. I think we watched Carolina basketball or something. Like, we were watching the game together, and it was way more positive than obviously when I got off the phone with her. And for me, it was always very interesting to be that far away. And I always kind of think about that because I live in California now, so we're very close, and even now we like FaceTime every day or every other day, and we watch football games together. And over FaceTime. So I think despite everything, it's at least solidified our relationship in a way. But yes.
Well, I definitely have some follow-up questions, some for my own sort of, you know, just interest. And then, of course, I'm thinking, like, about the listeners and people who are at different states of understanding, you know, as it relates to this issue, because there's some people who went through it and they're like, yep, same thing, same situation. I know exactly what he's talking about from firsthand experience. But also, like, what you would be going through. And then there's other people who might have literally just gotten the news about a family member and have no idea what to expect. So my line of questioning is, basically for everybody. So like, when you was talking to him, I'm assuming that he was not responsive, over the phone. Is that true?
Yeah, I think at the beginning he said hi.
Okay.
Then, you know, I was talking. My mom was like, he's trying, but they're putting him under now, so he's, like, getting sleepy. And so I think she was kind of translating what he was saying.
Okay.
And at the beginning, so I heard his voice for a little bit.
Okay.
Back then, I don't think FaceTime was, like, a big thing, because I feel like she would have FaceTimed me probably.
Right.
But this was 2010, so it wasn't something that was, like, super big back then.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately, I guess, for our family, my grandmother passed away 3 years later of a brain aneurysm as well because of high blood pressure. And so I was also in California at the time. No, this was my mom's mom.
Or your mom's mom?
Yeah, so this was the other side of the family. And so it was the same situation, but the ending was very different. And so it's something that's kind of played. And I think we all are a little bit better with our health. And I have high blood pressure, and I'm only 30, and I'm on high blood pressure medication already. And so it's something that we're very cognizant of. But I've been on both ends of being far away, and, you know, one making it home in time and, you know, one not making it home in time. So.
Mm-hmm.
And Sloan, I didn't mention this in the beginning, but I am a cerebral aneurysm survivor. So I have a coiled disc aneurysm. And so I watch everything like you say. And the only thing that my doctor said to me is the surgeon, is to stay away from anger, believe it or not. He didn't say anything about exercise or anything like that, because if you get angered or, you know, very, very flustered, then that can actually cause more of the inflammation and, you know, cause the onset of a rupture. So what I do is I just try to exercise. That's why this thing about exercise is so important to me. Is I try to exercise and I stay away from, like, quote-unquote drama or chaos, because, once again, if you monitor it, if you make sure you're not angered or you stay away from those situations, it really can truly, I don't know, just give you a better outlook. You know what I mean? Just give you a better outlook. Like,
yeah.
I make silly videos, TikTok videos and stuff like that. I stay away from that stuff. Have you found that to the high blood pressure? And I know that you have a very intense job, especially if you're an entertainment attorney.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I do get from my dad is I'm really goofy. And I like to make people if you knew him, then you know he's always laughing. He's always, like, making me laugh. And I at least take that part from him. I'm a little bit more serious sometimes, like my mom. I'm very studious like her, but I do find a tendency to, like, play around a lot, and my wife helps with that, and my puppy, you know, they're, like, the favorite things that keep me laughing. But my dad is always, like, I don't know, if I need to laugh, I usually call him, because he has a story, or he has has an adventure that he went on.
He always has a story.
But those those Al Bundy stories you were talking about, I probably know them by heart.
Todd's stories are those stories that have that unexpected ending.
Yeah.
You know?
He always has a story, and it's literally like, I'm like, what were you doing? He's like, oh, it was the 80s. Every single time. He's like, oh, it was the 80s. And I'm like, okay, I guess. I was like, the 80s must have been a really interesting time, because I never knew that was an excuse for it. But he, you know, so I think that keeps me.
The 80s were for a lot of things.
The 80s were the excuse. Apparently, I don't have that same excuse, because I was a 90s and a millennial, so I guess I can't say the same. But, I would say that being around my family and joking, and we're very close, and we have a very big family. But, you know, everybody's always laughing. There's always a lot of interesting energies going around, but we're always telling stories and joking and playing cards or watching movies or quoting movies, like me and my dad like to do all the time. So it just, I think that probably keeps everybody young and keeps our blood pressure down. And we're not really a drama family, I would say. We know all the drama about everybody else, but our family is not too heavy into it, so that also helps.
Yeah, definitely.
Big time.
I want to ask about the, have you all identified the stressors? The medical community tends to look at high blood pressure as connected to, like, foods you're eating, perhaps some of what you're actually doing for a living, but you all been able to, like, put a finger on it so that you can have more control over it? Because I look at high blood pressure as straight up, as a psychologist, you know, as straight up stress connected, you know. And so, like KJ said, in the end, she's engaging in a natural antidepressant to sort of help combat some of the anger that is almost inevitable to, like, experience. I mean, to say to avoid anger is kind of silly. Because that's like saying avoid your family, like, that you live with. That's what really needs to be happening is, you know, figure a game plan for maybe getting out of the house or, you know, of course, also prepping your body so that when you do experience some anger-provoking situation, it's less of a blow because the body's already, you know, it's stronger with the exercise or whatever, you know. So have you all identified that? Because that's something, like generationally, when you're thinking about, okay, Dad, I have it. It makes you wonder. Like, have you identified? Is it a thought pattern, or is it like more environmental, like outside of yourself?
I think my doctor has spoken to me about genetics being kind of predisposed to high blood pressure. And she talks about exercise. Obviously, I'm in a really stressful job, so that's something that I have to monitor and be creating a work-life balance that people who are attorneys often don't have. Is something that I've had to prioritize even early in my career, which is not ideal because there's a lot. Usually, you're supposed to be pulling late nights and, you know, sacrificing yourself at this point of your career to get ahead. And I've had to kind of find different ways to be able to, show my work ethic without actually causing harm to myself. But I don't know that. I think food-wise, I definitely have cut salt. I don't have a lot of salt in my diet. I don't drink sodas at all. I only really drink water. I don't really drink juices. I know my dad can't say the same. But I always get on him about his juices and his soda. But I drink coffee, so I think that's kind of my kryptonite, is I do like to have coffee. Just thinking about other, like, dietary things, I don't really have. I think probably me and my dad's biggest stressor is watching Carolina football and basketball. We're very vocal when it comes to sports. So sometimes I have to kind of watch myself and the level of, you know, intensity that I watch sports, my college sports with, at this stage, which some people, I mean, if you went to Carolina, you know how serious it is, or if you grew up kind of in like the ACC area, you know, especially Carolina Duke. So you know how some people, I joke around with people, but I'm in all seriousness, I'm like, it is something that we take very seriously, for better or worse.
I'm from New Jersey, and my freshman year, I was on the freshman float at Carolina. Well, of course, this was back, you know, in Fred Flintstone years, but they had the stuffed animals. They had not stuffed animals, you know, like the stuffed people, the foam people, and one had on a Carolina helmet, and he was like, oh, like fierce and everything, and then the other one had on a state helmet. They were the two dummies on the float, and the one with the state had blood all over it and everything. And I called my parents. We didn't have cell phones at that time. I had to get back to the dorm and use the rotary dial or whatever. And I was like, I was terrified. At this school, I want to come home. There was somebody with blood all over on the float, and everybody was excited. I was cheering for the, you know, the float with the blood all over the same person and the Carolina person. So, yes, I learned that sports here is very, very serious. Very serious. So I have a quick question for you guys. It's a geographic question, or a little, you know, question, whatever, series of questions. So basically what I did was I tried to Google to find out a little bit more about stroke. And just as I was reading about the strokes and the intensity of it, it blew me away. One of the things that stood out was the, please forgive me, there's an ischemic stroke. And basically, it occurs over 10 hours, and if it is unaddressed before the end of the 10 hours, it can actually, your brain can actually age 36 years.
Wow.
So I was reading about that, and I was just trying to find out more about, like, look, you know, just in case if a stroke happens, you want to make sure you're in the state with the most success, right? So I was trying to find out, what are the states that have the highest prevalence, and I found one with the top positions, but I lost it. I can't find that right now. But what are the states with the highest prevalence of stroke? And, you know, I was wondering, what do you guys think would be like, if you were to think along the lines of, you know, intensity of work and, you know, high blood pressure and all those other attributes out there, what are some of the states that you think might make the top 10 states for highest prevalence of stroke?
California and New York.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Nope, they're not in the top 9.
Interesting. Wow. Texas.
North Carolina.
Nope, not in the top 9.
And not Texas either? What she said, Texas either?
Nope, not in the top 9.
Georgia?
Chicago.
Nope.
Oh, good. I was about to say, not my home. Okay. What, New Jersey?
It better not be New Jersey. Bro, not my home.
It's on there? It's on there?
Let me give you number 9. I'll give you number 9. Number 9 is Mississippi. Highest prevalence of stroke.
Oh, places where maybe there's more racism or hostility. That would make sense. Because it's stress-induced stroke.
Mississippi,
perhaps.
Alabama, Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee.
Exactly right.
South Carolina.
There you go. He's so funny.
So,
Florida.
So you got nope. Try number 8. So number 9 is Mississippi. Number 8 is Washington D.C.
Oh yeah, that makes sense actually.
So politics.
Got all those politicians.
Yep, that makes sense.
Political issues and, you know, politics is, you know, is very polarized sometimes in that state. Or in Washington, D.C. Number 7 is Oklahoma.
Mm.
Number six is Louisiana.
Yep, there he said that.
Oh, wait. Oh, my God. You know what? I did it the wrong way.
It's the opposite.
Wait.
So, no, I don't think you told us, like, what number nine. Oh, yeah, you did. Number nine would be less.
I did the wrong way. So number nine is Kentucky. Number eight is Missouri. Number seven is Tennessee. Number six is Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Number five is Nevada.
Mm. Next to Cali.
Yes. Well, you think about it. You got a lot of the gambling and, you know, with high rollers, the high intensity, very polarized.
Yeah, good point.
Okay. Then comes Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
Oklahoma. I'm like, I wouldn't even think of Oklahoma. I'm like.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington, D.C. was number two, and Mississippi was number one. Mississippi was the highest. I did it the wrong way around. I'm sorry.
I mean, it does make some sense, although I am somewhat surprised Cali isn't in there. But then when I think about the fact that there's a huge body of people that are health conscious, it probably helps fight against the drama of Hollywood, which probably only represents a small percentage of the state, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will say the states that you named, I would think, would have more health issues in terms of their food eating habits and their exercise rather than stressors that might be, like, work-related. I think it could be higher genetically, especially if it's, like, in the southern parts where you try food. Where they drink a lot of alcohol, those things tend to increase, and also probably a skepticism of the medical industry as well, and not going to have regular checkups. And, you know, I think that's a big leader, particularly in the Black community, of high blood pressure, is just not wanting to go to the doctor, not wanting to, I mean, not necessarily sometimes wanting to, and not necessarily having health care either. But also having a mistrust of doctors and of medicine and not having regular checkups or even regularly checking your own high blood pressure.
But you know what? Then you still have to think about what is, it's not necessarily not going to the medical doctors that is causing high blood pressure. It's whatever it is, the lifestyle that's leading to it. Maybe it's stress-induced oppression. Maybe it's the types of food that we're eating, you know, the fact that we're using a lot of dairy products and butter and, you know, pork and all of this stuff we shouldn't be really eating. And, I mean, it's tough because, you know, on one end, it's, you know, sort of, I'm conditioned to, like, think that we need the system. And I know there's benefits to it, but then I also know, you know, about the history of why we don't seek medical attention. And it's a history that is hard to sort of ignore. And that's, you know, experiments that was done at these medical institutions, such as, you know, John Hopkins, for example, you know, where they're experimenting on people, Black people, and giving us diseases and, you know, seeing how we respond. And so it is tough, but in the end, I'm always about, like, okay, what's at the root of the issue? It's not going, you know, or to the medical institutions for help, but more like whatever it is that we're doing or not doing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it's also access. Sometimes we just don't have the same access to medical treatment and clinics, and they're overcrowded, and it's. It's a lot. I think it's a combination of a lot of things that disproportionately continue to affect the Black and Brown community.
That's true. Accessibility.
I think it's two phases. I think it's one about actually preventing the stroke, and then I think it's two, once it occurs, what are you doing to address it? And I as a teacher, I listen to so many people now, and it's a different mentality from when I was growing up as far as, like, that social acceptance and mental toughness and bravado.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I really talk about the pain threshold and the pain tolerance, because it's two completely different things. Just because your pain tolerance increases, that does not mean your pain threshold increases, right? Because if you have amount of pressure, if you have X amount of pressure, your aneurysm is going to rupture. Your stroke is going to occur. Your heart attack is going to occur. If you have X amount of pressure, right, which is what your body can handle, then something adverse is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that is your pain threshold. Your pain tolerance, beforehand, you may have had like 1/10 of it and said that hurts. And then you could move up to, you know, 1/2. I'm sorry, move up to, you know, whatever, you know, a lesser amount.
Yeah, like a fifth, and then up to fourth, and then a third and a half. Yeah, no, you're right.
And so your pain tolerance increases. You can handle more of the pain. Before you could handle 50% of the pain, now you can handle 75% of the pain. But if you get to 105%, which is, you know, 100 is your threshold, you get to 105%, it is going to be self-injurious. So, so the one part is doing the preventative things to make sure that you don't reach that 105%, right? And that's the awareness, that's the test, that's the, you know, the exercise, that's the diet, that's all the preventative measures. But then the other part, which is after it happens, you know, and once it happens, or once the incident occurs, do you go to the doctor? Is the doctor, you know, is the equipment going to be able to give you a fair assessment? I mean, I talk over and over again. I mean, I mentioned over and over again about the oximeter and how the oximeter has a disadvantage for people who have dark nail polish, tattoos, you know, darker complexion skin, because it actually gives you a higher rating on oxygen saturation, blood oxygen saturation, oxidation. So if you have that higher reading, you cannot now fault the doctor and say the doctor's not allowing you to have the extensive care that you need. It's actually in the equipment that's telling the doctor that it's okay. And if that's equipment that is across the board, then that's one thing. Now, studies have been out since 2007 stating that there was a disparity in the readings of the oximeter and the blood pressure cuff and all those other kind of things that are external measurement tools. But and recently, this year, I went to a 2021 National Science Foundation meeting for people who were applying for grants and et cetera. And at that particular meeting, they were talking about how much the, you know, how important it is to get this thing right with the oximeter. Because it is delaying the proper medical attention that individuals need. So, you know, like I said, it's two phases. And the one phase with regards to the medical equipment, if the doctors don't have the insight is needed, and the nurses don't have the insight that's needed. I mean, you think about it. When you go, they do an oximeter and they do a blood pressure cuff. Both of those are impacted by melanin. Both of those say, you know what, this person doesn't need to stay. This person can go home, or this person's well enough to go home. So, you know, having insight on the additional tests that are needed to make sure that you get a full, you know, battery or series of tests. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, this was helpful. It just made me start, as you were saying it made me think about, like, so pain threshold versus pain tolerance and the cultural sort of implications as far as, right, because we know culture isn't just ethnicity and nationality, like where you live, but it's, well, it's also age, you know, like all these different
definitely
things.
Age.
And so you said what?
Definitely age.
Right, exactly, right? Like religious affiliation, like a whole bunch of stuff, you know. So when I think of, like, where we live, the culture, right, of where we live as far as sports goes and pain tolerance and suck it up and man up and, you know, just like you said, shake it off. I forgot what term you used, Todd. In age, it just made me think, you know, times like this decade versus that decade, 80s versus 90s and 2000s, it makes me think, like, you know, if there was ever a disconnect or between, like, you know, what you went through and what was expected of you when you was, you know, in sports and had some minor injury, like, quote-unquote minor, and when your daughter had it Or was it, did it work out where you was able to be sensitive to her because of like the gender, you know, or even perhaps like your own medical stuff, even though your medical stuff I think came after you said her high school, because I think you said she was in college. So any of that kind of show up?
Well, I'm always aware of the times. Things aren't the same today as they were 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
That's right.
Things evolve and situations change and people change, just like the athlete today is not like the athlete was when I was coming up.
That's true.
And that's why it's not fair to compare the eras of sports, you know, different players, different times, different things. I take the LeBron James, Michael Jordan comparisons as an example. They were totally different players in two totally different times.
Exactly.
And they're always talking about the GOAT. Well, you know, in my opinion, the GOAT is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But
Exactly.
But those were different times and different eras, so I can't really argue with the person that thinks Jordan is the greatest or a person that thinks LeBron is the greatest just because I think Kareem is greatest. It's all about opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just how people interpret different times.
Right.
But you got to be sensitive to what other people go through and what other people are feeling because the times are changing. The things that student-athletes did when we were in college, you know, student-athletes today are not putting up with, you know.
That's true.
The NCAA to a plantation mentality.
That's real. That's not only super mature of a response, but it's true, even that whole comparison thing, like you said, they two different positions, like, so it's like, how does this even make sense? Two different eras. Like, I literally had this conversation with some grown men like 2 months ago and just shut the conversation down by just noting that. And then, right, like what you say as far as the mentality and, you know, I mean, that's so true. What do you think, KJ?
I think, yeah, the mentality is different. The mentality is different for based on the students that I speak with and the adults I speak with and even the parents as far as guiding them. But I'm wondering, beyond that mindset of the incident and that particular situation, what was your mindset, Todd, when you were recovering? Like, what do you think made you a part of that 30% who surpassed the 5-year threshold?
Just the will to live.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a will.
What do people
survive.
Say to you?
You can't give
what
up on anything.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see my children's success. I wanted to see my family's success. I wanted to be able to do the things that I did before, which I can't do a lot of the things that I did before, but a lot of things that I did before I can do better. I can't run. I have a hitch in my giddy up. I had gout when I was recovering, so it killed the nerve endings. It gave me foot drop. So I have basically no feeling in my left big toe, which that's not from the stroke. Well, it is from the stroke, but it's from the recovery part where I had gout, and it caused me to have foot drop. So I have a weak left side, and I can't run.
Oh.
But I can limp fast.
I can limp fast. Oh, you are so excellent. That is excellent. He said, I can limp fast. That's what I'm talking about. And this is helpful to the listeners to hear about potential, you know, like things that could come up so that they don't feel like this is abnormal of them to experience it, you know?
Exactly. But Todd, explain. So you're in the hospital, right? And you become conscious. What happens after that? Like, what are the steps to recovery?
I was paralyzed. I was paralyzed on my whole left side, the arms from my right side I could move, my right leg, my right arm I could move. My left arm was dead. My left leg was dead. It just took time. And I was actually going to therapy one day, and my left thumb actually moved.
Wow, physical therapy, right? Physical?
Yeah, physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And my left thumb moved. And I was able to slowly regain movement in my arms and then eventually in my legs. Slowly get movement through therapy and through the through hard work. It was a lot of hard work.
Wow.
Because but basically I feel, learned I feel, how to do stuff all over again.
It is. It's like being a grown up. And I'm just wondering, KJ, like real quick, how I don't know how many months or years did you begin to start feeling the movement in your left thumb, and then eventually walking like sort of at a normal pace.
Well, while I was in therapy, I was there for like 3 weeks. Physical therapy in the rehab facility, and when I came home, I was in a wheelchair.
Wow!
So I had to use a walker, and then I just had to, I worked it. I had to work hard to learn how to walk again.
Wow!
And I had a cane, and I had a walker, and then I threw the cane away, and I threw the walker away.
Oh, that's
I have an ASO that I wear today. A brace that I wear on my foot for the foot drop, but that's about it.
Wow. So, and that's quick, right? 3 weeks? Don't that sound quick, or is it not?
Well, but it took me about another month to where I could really walk.
I mean, that still sounds good. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize the struggle. I'm just thinking I think that sometimes when there's a complete loss of abilities, sometimes you might expect that it may take a long, long time because you're going from, being able to, not being able to do much, if anything. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, it will definitely humble you because I won't let your audience know the first thing that I wanted to do.
Right. Okay. I think they know. I think they know where you're going. Well, and that makes me think. Was there any mental health professionals around or anybody to because I'm assuming that like there was a level of loss, that came with and stress that came with not being able to do what you once was able to do. It came with having to depend on people for help. Not that you didn't trust your wife, but it's feeling like you're inconveniencing people and all these therapies. And so, was there any support there, or even spiritual support?
I had excellent support. I had the best wife in the world. I had the best children in the world. My mother was there for me. I had a total support cast. And be honest with you, mental health was not an issue.
Wow, that's huge.
I knew I was going to get better, and I just was always focused on doing everything as much as I could the way I did it before.
Wow.
That's the way I do it today.
So did you try to do more than the therapist told you to do, or did you do exactly what they told you to do?
Always try to push the limits.
That's right. Because they always give you the lowest probably so that, they're just trying to see what you're able to do. I mean, I could see that they're being careful. And so you always know you could do a little more than what they said.
Oh, I always push the limits.
Love that.
And I recovered, like she said earlier, I recovered quite fast.
Yeah, so you agree because I'm like, that seems pretty quickly, but it makes sense now that you give sort of your position on, go get it, this like this desire to regain, and where were you spiritually? Because it sounds like you definitely have some help.
Oh, spiritually, I'm always there. I'm blessed.
Yes, for sure.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it by myself. I had to have help.
That's the truth.
I'm not the most religious person in the world, Not as much as my wife, but, you know, I believe.
So you know she was praying.
And I do know there's a higher power and that I am a witness to a higher power.
That's it. That's it.
Todd, if you were to do anything differently or if you were to add anything or anything, what would you say you would do differently either before? Well, let's do the two things. Before the incident, before the car, or, you know, during the recovery period, what would you do?
I would have had, I only went to the doctor when I had to. I would have had normal checkups. I would have known that I had high blood pressure, and I probably wouldn't have been in that position.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that happens, you got to deal with it. You take your lumps and you move on.
And then post the seizure, because you had five major life changing health challenges, right?
Well, I've had an emergency appendectomy.
Mm-hmm.
My appendix burst. This was a few years ago. This was after the stroke. I had to have the poison pumped out of me from the appendix bursting. I have had seizures after the stroke. I had a couple seizures.
Is that connected to the stroke or no?
It was a result of the stroke because, you know, it was scar tissue. I still have to take Keppra daily to prevent seizures.
Okay.
And they have something called mimic stroke or minor stroke, and basically those are seizures. So sometimes seizures can be misdiagnosed.
When I was sitting here watching TV, I would have like a seizure that would last maybe 30 seconds to a minute. And then I would be all right. I would just have to take deep breaths. I would feel it coming on. My body would seize on my left side, and my arm would start jerking, and my leg would start jerking, and then it would go away.
And that's the actual symptom of the seizure. But how would you know it was coming on? What was that feeling, or what would occur?
My arm would just start involuntarily twitching, and my leg would involuntarily twitch. Actually, my daughter was with me when I had one. Mm-hmm. We were at a state championship basketball game, and we were in Chapel Hill, and I had to go to the ER down there. This was a couple months after I came home.
Now, is there a trigger? Like, did you say? Like, is there, you know, the lights or bright or anything?
Well, my daughter could tell you more than me because she was sitting right beside me.
What happened to the seizure?
Well, I was actually watching the game and not him, so I wasn't being a very good caretaker. I looked at him and I could kind of tell like his eyes he wasn't focusing. And then I saw him, like, shaking. And I wasn't around when the stroke happened. So this is kind of my first encounter. And it was just me and him and I think one of his friends. Because I was in Chapel Hill and he was coming to visit me. And his friend had rode with him. I didn't really know what to do. I just saw it lasted for about a minute. And, of course, it was enough he was shaking enough to where it drew a lot of attention. The medical professionals came down and, you know, I told them, like, his history. And I don't know if he had taken his medication that day. I think that might have been a day that he had not taken it or he hadn't taken his second dose. And so I was kind of there with the doctor talking it through, and it was really scary because I didn't know if it was, you know, it was, I knew it was more of a seizure than a stroke, but I didn't know what the long-term effects of it would be. And then,
wow.
You know, once he was in the, I think we were in the Dean Dome, and once we went to, like, the medical center, and, like, towards the end of it, he was fine. He was like, all right, I'm ready to go get something to eat. And I was still freaked out.
Trying to get some attention.
And I'll call my mom. I was like, you need to travel with him everywhere. Like, why did you let him come down here by himself?
Oh, no.
I was like, I can't do this. I was like, you need to go with him when he goes places because this is not okay. And so, and he's still sitting there. He's just like, take me to get some food. So I definitely was not. I was also like 20 years old, so maybe I handle it a little better now.
And, you know, Ty was just trying to get to the game con. You know, the camera.
he was, I gotta say, everybody was like, and I think most, it was, we were watching our, like, basketball team from our hometown. So most of the people who were there knew, I think, at least about his stroke. We come from a very small town. So I think most of the people who were there watching the basketball game kind of knew. And they knew to check in, and I'm sure somebody probably told my mom before I even got to call her. But yeah, I think we traveled together one more. I think we traveled. He came with me to visit law school, and so he came to California with me. It was just me and him to visit Berkeley, and I was very adamant about his medication. And not leaving him, to his own devices too much of the trip. But he's, you know, he's super independent, so I can't really tell. I can't tell him anything as long as he takes his medication. He's, you know, he basically was at the bar at Berkeley, and he knew everybody, and everybody knew my name because he was there, and he had made friends while I was off trying to figure out where I was going to live. So it was. He probably had more fun there than I did.
Now let's talk a little bit about the whole the medication that they prescribed and taking it and prescribed and all of that stuff. So this is this is how it is, or is it that was just a particular drug that they prescribed? Like, are some once a day so that remembering is easier?
No, I take. Only medication I take is high blood pressure medicine, cholesterol medicine, gout medicine, and Keppra for seizures.
Okay, so the Keppra, it's twice a day? That's the one that's twice a day?
It's twice a day. Or I could take two in the morning, just as long as I take 1,500 milligrams.
Okay. And is it, so let's get a little bit into that, just a little bit. Is it the case that you didn't want to take two because you felt like one would be enough, or was it you forgot or some other reason?
No, actually, I was taking it then.
Mm-hmm.
They had given me, because I wasn't, they hadn't had me on it regularly. When I came out of the hospital, they had given me Neurontin or Dilantin, I forget which one it was, and they didn't tell me I had to take it every day, or I didn't have to take it at that point every day. But after the seizure, I was prescribed to take it every day, and that the seizures brought on me having to take it every day. I wasn't prescribed to take it every day then.
And it makes sense because in the end, the seizures came, you know, after the stroke. It wasn't like you had a history of seizures. So it wasn't an issue that you weren't taking your medicine that's prescribed, which is good for your daughter to hit because that's, I think, what she was thinking, you know.
No. I wasn't even prescribed the medication then. But once I left there, I was prescribed it.
See, that can reduce a little bit of the stress because, you know, like he will behave next time y'all are out or, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's been 10 years, then 11, almost 11 years since I've had a seizure. So
Wow.
I only had that one.
So do you have to take medicine?
Huh?
Do you still have to take the medicine or no?
Oh, I take it every day.
Wow.
It's a preventative medicine. I have to take it. It's preventative.
Right.
And I would not stop taking it because I don't want to have a seizure.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So were there any other side effects of the stroke? The seizures,
just the fact that I have foot drop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Todd, you are very lucky because I'm telling you, I've been reading the numbers, I've been reading the facts about stroke just to prepare for this conversation with you. And like I said, there are not a lot of people who have the same success, but it seems as though, once again, I mentioned those three athletes who recovered quite quickly. It seems as though sport is, or physical activity is a part of it, the recovery process. Everything that I've read for even seasoned citizens, because I told you the average age is 60, they highly recommend aerobic activity for a quicker recovery or for a more complete, comprehensive recovery. So,
and also, the athletes that you were describing, they had clot strokes. Clot strokes are less – let me see how I can explain this. If you have a clot stroke where they put you on blood thinners and stuff like that, you're more likely – you're more danger to have another stroke down the road. But if you have a bleeder like I had, a hemorrhagic stroke, they're more deadly immediately.
That makes sense.
The fatality rate is higher. But if you survive it, the chances of you having another stroke are less.
Than the clot stroke, because the clots can come back,
especially if you don't take your thinners, your blood thinners and whatnot. Well, this is what I've learned. This is what the doctor told me. The doctor told me that 70% of the people that have the type of stroke I had die.
Yeah, and that matches up with KJ's number.
That's exactly what I said. I said only – it actually said 26.7.
But if you survive it, you have a better chance of leading a normal life than if you had a clot stroke.
Right, okay.
Because the clot stroke, you're going to always be having to take the thinners and always are susceptible to getting another clot.
Wow. So it's not, you know, it's so tough because it's like, which one would you rather have? Like, really, neither, you know, but it's like, okay, and that makes me think, so maternal grandmother, I'm assuming, had then a hemorrhagic stroke, or was it the clot?
My mother-in-law.
Yes, she had the same type that you had then?
Yes, aneurysms are a byproduct of a hemorrhagic stroke.
Exactly. Todd and Sloan, based on everything that we've discussed tonight, can you think of anything else that might be important for listeners to hear, learn about strokes and the recovery? And, you know, the symptoms, the onset, the recovery. And I
I really don't know how to say anything about the symptoms because I didn't have any symptoms. I was perfectly healthy. Like I said, I did not know that I had
high blood pressure.
But the recovery is, you just got to be diligent. You've got to stick to the plan. You can't cut corners. You can't do it your way. You can't be stubborn. You can't be mule-headed. You got to listen to the doctors. You got to listen to the therapists, and you've got to work hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be easy.
Yeah. Good advice.
But that's all I can say about it.
Mm-hmm. It's good. It's good, though. And it sounds like, for sure, you know, the spiritual component of it is big, because you know that you have a praying wife that has your back on that realm, you know, and it just... It's almost like, you know, you done went through enough in these last, you know, decade or how much, 2 decades that.
It was 2010.